Heard docket number 84126. Are you all ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I know this is kind of unusual in that we have no respondent, but we have counsel on behalf of appellant. We have legal aid on behalf of the subject minors. I'm assuming you're just going to argue for 15 minutes apiece. I don't know from reading the pleadings, honestly, but there seems to be a unity of interest amongst the two of you. So I don't know if you want, I know there was a reply brief filed. Do you want rebuttal time or do you just want to argue your 15 minutes?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. I think what I'll do is I'll focus on the substantial enhancement argument. Ms. Dahlia Hunt will focus on the guardian ad litem, and I intend to reserve 2 minutes just as a summation.
Okay, very good. All right, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Andrew Clark of Littler Mendelson for the appellant, Ms. Randy Sue Nauffer, who's present in the courtroom and is the maternal grandmother and former guardian of the three minors at the heart of this case. Your Honor, the district court terminated a permanent guardianship while applying the incorrect legal standard. For that reason, and for two others, we ask that the court vacate and remand. First, the district court knowingly and intentionally applied the best interest analysis from NRS 125C instead of the substantial enhancement test outlined in NRS 159A. The intentional application of the incorrect legal standard is reviewed for plain error, but it was also an abuse of discretion to find.
How would you describe the difference between those two tests?
Between the best interest and the substantial enhancement? Substantial enhancement has a degree of improvement that just simply isn't there in the best interest analysis. When you look at the 12 factors that are at issue 125C, those really are asking between two parents which one is better, but there's not a discussion or even an opportunity in those factors to state which one is better and by how much. I think substantial enhancement is a self-defining term in that it means to significantly improve, and just a plain application of the best interest factors really only determines who's better and not by any sort of degree. And so
are we then imposing a higher standard or more stringent standard on the termination of guardianship than we would in other custodial scenarios, such as changing custody from one parent to the other? We've been grappling with this issue because it does seem like the statute is imposing a more stringent standard than just best interest of the child.
I agree. It is a more stringent standard, but the two proceedings differ in a way that warrants that. 159A, the guardianship statute, presupposes that there's already been the kind of extraordinary remedy or finding by a district court that a parent at some point in time was unsuitable and has already appointed a non-parent guardian.
Did Ms. Rahman, did she consent to the termination of the for the establishment of the guardianship?
She did not consent. She did not consent. The district court got that right, found that she did not consent. Which, to your point, means that she did have to show the elevated substantial enhancement substantial enhancement of the child's well-being.
What if the parent doesn't know that a guardianship has been sought? How does that affect? It's like you didn't consent, you didn't not consent, right? And so, why would we prejudice the parent later on and make them proceed under that welfare substantially enhanced second section of the statute if they never knew a guardianship had been thought?
I think there are two questions there. I think the first as to why we would impose a higher burden on the parent who doesn't consent. One, I think there are other remedies for a parent who may not have known, or in the case here, who disputed service of the initial guardianship proceeding. Had Ms. Rahman, at the time of the guardianship, gone to court to either move to reconsider or set aside the guardianship for fraud or for lack of service, she had the opportunity to do that, but she didn't do that here either. And so the facts here are that she did not consent, despite Ms. Nauffer serving her at the address that she had been given and the initial guardianship court acknowledging that she had been served.
So you are making a distinction between not opposing and consenting, which I find a little interesting because in, say, this regular civil context, right, if somebody doesn't oppose a motion, they're deemed to have consented to the motion being granted. So how do you square all that?
Well, I think she did not oppose the motion, and so to or the petition for guardianship. So to that extent, that could be deemed consent. My point was only that had she truly not had notice or an opportunity to consent, as she might have argued, she had other remedies to satisfy that if she truly wasn't served, which we believe that she was. And so to the extent that there's a differentiation between the failure to respond being consent or needing an affirmative consent, that's not necessarily clear from the statute. But I would agree with Your Honor that the failure to oppose would be consent.
When we look at the facts of this case, wouldn't they rather weigh towards consent because she voluntarily turned the kids over to her mom to take care of them, to grandma to take care of them?
I think that the facts lend towards an abdication of the parental role, but not necessarily a consent to the guardianship proceeding. And I think that's evident in the fact that Ms. Knopfler continually tried to get Ms. Robin to provide her the information to get kids enrolled in school. She didn't provide that. Tried to get her permission to allow her to take the kids across state lines, which I think is important to the consent to a guardianship question, because Ms. Rahman wouldn't provide that. And so I believe that the facts here don't push the court towards finding a finding of consent as much as just an abdication of the parental role, and certainly not the acknowledgement that a guardianship was necessary. And I think that that is kind of the point and why 159 differentiates the standard. Not that it punishes parents for litigating a guardianship case, but that it benefits parents who recognize the problem and affirmatively consent.
If our overall policy concern is best interest of the kids, does that make sense?
In the guardianship context, I would, and especially in a parent petitioning for a non-emancipated minor, as 1915 sets out, I think best interest is just the first kind of threshold showing of not the sole consideration as it is in 125C. And so I would push back a little on the best interest is important, but because this parent has already been found not to be suitable, they have to show that it would be far better.
No one is disputing that she's been restored to suitability, my understanding, right? So that first prong has been met. But on that second prong, I understand what you're saying. There's a dictionary definition of substantially enhanced. And I think the court was using the best interest of this of the child standard to try to fill in, to have some kind of analysis to be able to figure out whether or not the child welfare would be substantially enhanced. What additional finding would you have had the court make beyond what was set forth in the order?
I think at minimum, there has to be a finding of degree. When we look at the 125C factors that the district court analyzed, the first two factors, who the parent nominates as guardian, obviously that fell to Ms. Rahman, she nominated herself, and what Ms. Dahlia Hunt will talk more about, the child's interest and who they want to be with, those two are unhelpful. But the rest of the factors that the district court analyzed were either neutral or they favored Ms. Knopfler. And so at minimum...
What about the parental preference? Should that apply within the guardianship context?
Well, the parental preference should not have applied here because when we look at, and the district court, to its credit, analyzed two of the factors from Lachlan. But we have a mother with a history of advocating parental responsibilities, not just to Ms. Knopfler, but earlier to the boy's father, even though there were CPS issues there. We would argue that the parental preference did not apply under the 13 Lachlan.
Why would it even be a consideration here under 1915? I mean, the parent has to prove suitability, a change of circumstances, and then if they didn't consent, they have to prove an increase in the substantial welfare or a substantial enhancement to the welfare of the child. Parental preference doesn't really even seem to be applicable to that. It's like you can say, well, parental preference, but the parent also has to prove their suitability. That's not really a preference. So it doesn't seem that it even applies in the termination of the guardianship.
And I would agree to the extent that here you're correct. And frankly, the factors that the court analyzed in the best interest analysis didn't favor termination anyway. But we bring up the parental preference because it's unclear from the order whether the district court relied on the parental preference to show that degree of improvement necessary, because the best interest factors simply don't.
So when you say degree of improvement, like practically, what does that look like? Does the district court judge have to say, I determine the kids are 10% better off with mom than grandma? And like what's, and then what's the number?
The purpose, I think, and the point of using a substantial enhancement test that isn't specifically defined, I think gives some leeway there, that it isn't, that it has to be 75% or 65%. But I do think that the district court at minimum needs to be able to demonstrate why it's better than just 51%, because that is certainly is not significantly better.
So in the, if these children had been removed from child protective services, there would not need to be a showing that there was a substantial enhancement returning them to their parents. So I'm curious about the policy consideration in a guardianship setting where, you know, mom wasn't even fighting the guardianship, that there would have to be something extra for her to get her kids back.
It comes back to the courts having to be involved, finding that she was unsuitable. And the history of her unsuitability is abandonment, which we unfortunately have seen even since the termination. And so to answer your question, the issue is that parents who have a history of abandoning their children, even if they have been restored to suitability now, they have to show that we're not going to be back here again 6 months, a year later, and that it will be so substantially better for the children to return to their custody that we kind of accept that risk that we may have a parent abandon again and be back in the guardianship context.
Where are the children now?
We don't know, Your Honor. Initially, Ms. Rahman's home that she did the home visit with was in Arizona. Even before we filed,
I only want you to answer this if this is something in the record that speaks to this. We know legal aid was asked to make contact, didn't make contact, got appointed for the kids.
Well, I just want to know if they're in Ms. Rahman's custody right now, because they were out of her custody for 2 years. I didn't know if while these proceedings were going on, if the kids were still with grandma or with mom.
They have not been with grandma. We okay. We don't know who they've been with. And I take your point, Justice Arnett, about the record.
One of the things that I wanted to assure myself of, my understanding is in this proceeding, you're not challenging that mom was found suitable and that was appropriate decision by the district court. We're only challenging the aspect that the district court didn't make an appropriate finding of welfare would be substantially enhanced.
There's evidence that mom was returned to suitability, and to the extent that the district court found that, there is evidence to support that finding. We didn't challenge that, but I don't think that is reason enough, not only for the substantial enhancement follow-up issue, but also because that finding was made without the boys having any say through the entire process. And so any finding that the mom was returned to suitability or that she would be in any way better is missing the boys' testimony, which Ms. Dalian will speak more about. But to the extent that we did not challenge suitability, that does not defeat the other arguments or the reason to remand.
So in sum, you're saying that the court should analyze the best interests of the child standard, as that is the North Star for all cases involving children, but should have also additionally then analyzed whether or not their welfare would have been substantially enhanced on top of everything else.
Yes, that 1915, 159A 1915 okay. requires that it is more than just the best interest. And if it's okay with your honors, I will reserve the remaining time.
Right,
Thank you.
Morning. Marina Dahlia Hunt on behalf of the minor children. I would note, as Your Honor noted, that legal aid was appointed to represent the children in this manner. We were not able to make contact with them, so our arguments are limited to what was available in the record. But based on what the limited information in the record, we do, I, on behalf of the children, join the arguments of the appellant with regard to the incorrect application of the custody standard to a guardianship context, both as inapplicable in the context of guardianship because it compares two fit parents rather than at least a previously unfit parent with a non-parent, and because it is insufficient to assess whether termination would substantially enhance the children's well-being. But I would like to focus the majority of my time on the second issue here in this matter, which was the appointment of a guardian ad litem who is an attorney in lieu of the appointment of an attorney for the children at the trial court level.
Was there an express request for the appointment of an attorney prior to the evidentiary hearing?
Yes. Well, express is maybe not the word I would use. What the counsel for the guardian asked for was a guardian ad litem or something to speak with the children and make sure they have a voice in court. And then what the district court described as who she was appointing was someone who would meet with the children and both make recommendations with regard to the children's best interest, but with a mind toward their express interests. And she even noted that she would be willing to appoint multiple guardians ad litem if the children had a conflict in their express wishes. So the yes and no. There was a, I believe what the,
the guardian didn't actually act. There's a distinction between guardian ad litem and an attorney's role in these type of cases. The guardian ad litem seemed to, at least based on the record before us, to act more in the capacity of a guardian ad litem and not an attorney for the children.
That is correct, though she kind of walked the line between the two. She was very clear throughout the record that she was a guardian ad litem, that she did not have a duty to meet with the children. In fact, she, at a hearing in September, refused to meet with the children. She didn't believe it was appropriate under the circumstances of the case. But then during the evidentiary hearing, she also made an opening statement, cross-examined witnesses, made evidentiary objections. So she acted in the capacity of an attorney, but almost an attorney for the court rather than for the children.
How would someone, so if we start from the idea that an attorney represents, at least for verbal kids, the interests, the desires of the kids, and the guardian ad litem is presenting best interest to the court, how could somebody determine the best interests without having a conversation with the children?
I don't believe that it's possible to determine what's in a child's best interest without having a conversation with that child. I think that that is one of the fundamental flaws of this case. The children were deprived any access to anyone who could even explain the proceedings.
How old were the kids at the time of the proceeding?
I believe they were, the oldest was born in 2011. So I believe they were 10, 8, and 6, or right around there. They were certainly verbal. Just candidly, I don't, if I had been appointed as the attorney for the children, I don't know that I would have had them testify. But they certainly have information that could lead to admissible evidence in line with their interests. And an attorney could have called witnesses that further their interests, could have made legal arguments by applying not just NRS 159A1915, but also the Lachlan factors. If mom has been restored suitability, those factors still allow for the court to override the parental preference in the context of guardianship for extraordinary circumstances. The district court noted that this was an extraordinary case with a very long history of abuse. The children were diagnosed with PTSD along with other mental health issues. And I know there were issues with the mental health record, but they beyond anyone else are affected by the outcome of this matter. And they were the only ones without counsel, and the only ones denied access to the court system. When the statute was overhauled in 2017, there was a clear path created for appointment of counsel for children in minor guardianship proceedings separate from the appointment of a guardian ad litem.
And but that statute is permissive, right? It says may, not shall.
It is permissive, except in the context of the appointment of a guardian ad litem, what the language says is the court may not appoint an attorney as a guardian ad litem or an advocate for the best interests of a protected minor or proposed protected minor unless the court believes that an attorney who represents the protected minor or provokes protected minor is unable to provide information which is required by the court to make a determination on the best interest of the minor. So I believe it presupposes the appointment of an attorney before the appointment of a guardian ad litem.
Presuppose that. All that does is tell us a qualification on who can be a guardian. Guardian ad litem, excuse me. It doesn't say you have to have an attorney in place before you can afford a guardian ad litem. It just says a guardian ad litem cannot be an attorney unless.
So it says it may not appoint an attorney as a guardian ad litem. It uses the present tense. So it says an attorney who represents. It assumes
right, by. It's a qualification on who can act as a guardian ad litem.
I'm sorry?
It's a qualification on who can be appointed as a guardian ad litem.
Yes.
It cannot be an attorney unless there's these other factors are met.
Correct.
But it can be anybody else.
Yes, but here the court appointed an attorney.
Right, but this doesn't say you have to have an attorney before you can appoint a guardian ad litem.
I believe throughout the legislative history of the reforms to 159A that the at least statutory preference was to appoint an attorney before the appointment of a guardian ad litem for children. I would also note that NRS 159A.1915.2 says, upon the filing of a petition, the court shall appoint an attorney to represent the protected minor if the protected minor is unable to retain an attorney or the court determines that the appointment is necessary to protect the interests of the protected minor. I don't even think that is mandatory appointment, but I do believe that it just further shows that there's a preference for appointment of counsel for children, at the very least in the context of a termination proceeding.
Well, the concern is, I mean, and I'm concerned that the children weren't adequately represented for sure, that they didn't have their voices heard. However, I don't know that if we want to impose a duty on the district court judges to sua sponte appoint attorneys when they weren't asked for. My understanding is that the equivocal statement that you noted earlier about maybe a guardian or an attorney, and it was kind of this equivocal request. And then after the evidentiary hearing, some weeks later, the kids themselves asked for the appointment of an attorney. I don't know what benefit that could have had for them at that point, since the hearing had already happened. I'm grappling with, I mean, is that an abuse of discretion at the district court level when nobody really expressly asked for the appointment of an attorney?
Well, I think the issue there is no one was protecting the voices of the children. The children are the crux of this case. And if no other party is going to ask for the appointment of counsel for functionally a third party to the case, it has to be someone's job to protect the children. That is the court's fundamental duty, to protect the rights of the children. I believe in this court's decision in In Re Guardianship of DMF, the court found that children have fundamental due process rights in the sphere of guardianship cases, which include the right to notice and the right to be heard. These were 6, 8, and 11-year-old children. They cannot be heard by themselves. They can't appear in court, make evidentiary objections. That is what an attorney does. And the lack of an attorney for children specifically prevented them from having any kind of ability to have a say in these proceedings, even if the outcome had been the same. The attorney for children is not just an attorney, but also a counselor at law. The attorney could have negotiated a potential settlement, a potential transition plan, could have counseled the children on potential outcomes to the case. Throughout the case, it was basically, this is going forward, and all of a sudden, now you live with your mom.
How long have they been out of custody? I'm sorry, how long have they been out of grandma's custody?
The guardianship was terminated on December 26, 2021. So, 2.5 years.
You would acknowledge, even taking those points, that the court was faced basically with two people that it didn't find particularly attractive in any vein to have custody of these kids. Both had been arrested for domestic violence. Both had allegations of mental health issues. Both had allegations of not really doing best by these kids. And the court seemed to go in and lay all that out. Like, here's all the cards on the table. Honestly, here's what I think of everybody. But it just seems that this situation with mom is now better because I find that she's returned to suitability and has a better living arrangement, an income now, and the ability to provide for the medical needs better than grandma.
Do I agree with that proposition?
Do you agree that that's kind of what the court was faced with and kind of what the court went through and found?
With the evidence presented, I agree that that is what the court ultimately determined. Unlike counsel for the appellant, I think that the NRS 159A/1915A also requires not just a restoration to suitability, but also a correction in the underlying reason for need for guardianship. The correction for reason for need for guardianship was the long history of instability and medical neglect and physical abuse and bouncing around. So I think that the court kind of conflated the mom has a great job and a great house with what are the specific needs of these specific special needs children. So again, had the children had an attorney, they may have argued that at the district court level, but they did not.
To go back to the statute, so would you agree that because the court was appointing a person who was an attorney, that the statute would require first for that person to be appointed as an attorney for the children, not a guardian ad litem?
Yes. And I do believe that the Nevada statewide rules of guardianship kind of anticipate that requirement as well. Rule 9, which the court kind of cited to several times in each of the requests for separate or new counsel for the children. Rule A says a protected person or proposed protected person has a right to legal representation and shall be entitled to retain an attorney of his or her choosing. So all of the supporting documents, all of the legislative history, all points to appointment of counsel in both the adult and minor context, since the rules apply to both guardianship, both forms of guardianship. And so separately from the lack, from kind of whether or not the appointment should have happened, I also believe it was an abuse of discretion for the court to fail to appoint a guardian ad litem. I'd like to just briefly highlight what did not happen here. So the court at the beginning of this evidentiary hearing noted that this was an extraordinary case with extraordinary facts that were very, very, very concerning. And the court said, I need as much information as possible, and appointed a guardian ad litem who was meant to meet with the children, which I've already noted. But then at every step, I believe there were three separate.
Let me just interrupt you real quick. Would you agree with that finding by the court that it was kind of an extraordinary case with extraordinary circumstances?
Candidly, this is a relatively standard guardianship case for children. I do agree that there were more medical records than typical. So there may have been a role for a guardian ad litem. My argument is not that there should never be a guardian ad litem appointed for children. They are certainly valuable, especially in the context of estate cases where an estate has been misappropriated. It's relatively rare for a child to want to sue their parent for misappropriating their inheritance. And guardians ad litem have done great work, this guardian ad litem included, to recover children's estate when children expressly do not wish to go after their parents. But on the facts of the case, no, this is a relatively standard guardianship that involves a history of instability and abuse. It's relatively commonplace, unfortunately. So separately, as I mentioned before, the court does have an independent obligation to protect the rights and safety of children in these proceedings. The court, at the inception of the kind of termination proceeding, noted its concerns about the children's safety and well-being. And every other party in this matter was represented by counsel and was able to make argument, and the children were the only ones denied that ability. Further, the appointment of an attorney elevates a child to essentially party status under NRS 159A.0483. Without an attorney, the children didn't have any pretrial memoranda filed, no witnesses were called for the children, no exhibits were presented for the children, no expert witnesses were called for the children, which may have been appropriate. No cross-examination of the witnesses took place with the children's goal in mind, nor were any objections made on admissibility of evidence. No closing arguments or briefing was submitted with the children's goals in mind. The children didn't have an opportunity to potentially testify through alternate means if it had been appropriate in counseling with their attorney, and had no ability to have a say in the transition factors, and no argument was made as to the Lachlan factors. So with that, I would just ask that the court reverse. Thank you.
You can finish your thought.
Thank you. So the children were fundamentally denied their ability to be heard in these proceedings. So for those reasons and the reasons outlined by the appellant, this court should reverse the termination and remand with the specific instruction that the district court must appoint counsel for the children. Thank you.
By the way, you all like the mood lighting that happened?
I know.
Right? We try and keep everybody nice and comfortable. We've got a ghost in the system right now. So the lights may flicker at times, toilets flush on their own. It's kind of weird, but I apologize.
It's the most soothing argument I've ever been a part of. Thank you.
Thank you.
Two quick points, just to summarize. I wanted to just return to your question, Justice Herndon, about whether the district court could throw up its hands and say, I don't love both options, but I'm going to find for mom and I'm going to terminate. I think that is expressly not allowed under the substantial enhancement test, because getting back to what Justice Bell's concern is, if we're going to put a percentage on it, that certainly wasn't 60 or 65, or that may have been 50.01%. And so under NRS 159A 1915, that second prong, that is not substantially better. It is maybe just better, and that's not enough. And then even if we were to assume that the district court could use the best interest analysis to show a substantial enhancement, that wasn't the case here. And the substantial evidence, like Justice Herndon mentioned, was that this was a pretty even case, and a tie just doesn't go to the petitioner. A tie must go to the guardian.
But just to clarify, do you think the parental preference would apply, though, in the guardianship context? Because that may be, I mean, I understand what you're saying about substantial enhancement, but if there's a preference for the parent.
If there is a preference for the parent, well, to answer your question, no, I don't think it should have applied here. I think that whether.
It either applies to guardianship terminations or it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't expressly apply, so that's why I'm asking, should it apply?
Yes, I think that it can apply in the guardianship context. And would just distinguish, just because it's a holistic analysis and the substantial enhancement test could include other things. And so for that.
Let me ask you one quick question. Do you think it's inappropriate or okay for the district court to consider the best interest factors, assuming they're also analyzing the idea of whether welfare is substantially enhanced? Not to say they use the factor solely as the determination of that, but assuming they're doing an appropriate analysis here, is there any reason why they can't tie into that those factors under best interests?
They can. But they also must demonstrate that it is substantially better.
Your position here is that although the court did that, they didn't really weigh in favor of a substantial enhancement.
Correct. And it was a substitution for the substantial interest, not a supplement to the substantial enhancement. Okay, and for that reason, we ask that the court vacate.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Dahlia Hunt, thank you both very much.